This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hello, welcome to episode 219 of the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today in the podcast, we welcome MC Taylor of Hiss, Golden Messenger, and X Ignota. They may have not crossed your path. That's okay. Upon further inspection, a singer-songwriter signed to Merge may bring many questions and not as enough answers. Well, actually, we met through a post I made on Instagram of an older band, and I was like, that name is familiar. So I reached out, and after recognizing his name from his old band on Ebullition, which was a hardcore band from the 90s in Goleta and Santa Barbara, I thought, if his Golden Messenger is playing Santa Barbara, why don't we do the podcast there? So I drove up to Santa Barbara, and we spoke in person, and MC was insanely generous with his time and even shouted out the podcast to the crowd, and it was a great, great time, and I think you're going to really enjoy. And MC had house shows that would make anyone yearn for a time machine, and his love for early emo is really deep, and I learned a ton from him during this conversation. So it's great to know that someone that's doing, you know, a full-time career as a musician, as Hiss Golden Messenger, has a history in hardcore and emo. So you can hear it in his songs. There's a little hardcore in them, and I think you will really, really enjoy that. So thank you all the Patreon supporters out there. If you want to support, head on over to patreon.com/washedupemo. Thank you to Double Elvis Podcast Network. Learn about their award-winning podcast at doubleelvis.com. This is episode 219 of the Washed Up Emo podcast with MC Taylor from Hiss Golden Messenger and X Ignota.
Taylor, of a group called Hiss Golden Messenger. We are in Santa Barbara, California, and it's March 1st, 2023.
And it's cold.
Strangely cold.
It's strangely cold today. Your first band was, pronounce it for me, or one the band that was on...
On Ebullition.
Yeah.
My first band was... Well, we started out being called IG88, and we, after a couple months, we changed the name of the band to X Ignota, and it was a hardcore band, and we made records for Ebullition, which is a record label based very close to here
down the street.
In Goleta.
Yeah.
Or I don't know if they're still in Goleta, but when I lived here...
When was that?
I lived here from 1994 to 97, maybe, or 93 to 97. I got my undergrad at Santa Barbara.
So you're a gaucho?
I'm a gaucho. And so I came to Santa Barbara already into hardcore music.
Where were you before? Where were you?
I was in Orange County. I grew up in Orange County.
Okay, you grew up in Orange County. Okay.
I grew up in Orange County. So I was close to a lot of stuff, although I think I wasn't totally conscious of stuff that may have been happening very close to me because I wasn't on the internet. I mean, I don't think any of us were. So it was largely word of mouth and record stores. But being in Orange County, I was close to San Diego, and there was the whole scene based around like Struggle, Swing Kids, Justin Pearson, what later became 3-1-G. And
how did you find that stuff?
That stuff came kind of later. That came when I got to Santa Barbara.
But when you were in Orange County, what stuff was popping up for you?
The first show that I ever saw, the first sort of like punk rock hardcore show, warehouse show that I ever saw that wasn't like a big stadium show, was a band called, it was in Fullerton. This is actually really, this was a very big night for me because it was the first night that I ever got stoned also. So it was the first night that I ever smoked weed, and it was also the first night that I ever went to see a hardcore show.
Wow.
It was like an earth shattering. I mean, it was, you know what I mean? It
How
was
old
like,
were you?
It was, I was 16. And I went to Fullerton and I saw, I wish I could remember what the whole bill was, but I saw a band called Sludge Pot that
never heard of them.
That evolved into Evergreen.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's a good first one.
Really good. And Evergreen became like, that's like my band. And I later met Jason Bosel, who played drums in Evergreen, and he ended up playing drums in Rilo Kiley and with Jenny Lewis.
Yeah, of course.
Forever. And Jason and I did some songwriting together like relatively recently in the
past. Was that a trip?
5 years. I mean, the first time I ever hung with him, I went there. And he was like, I think he
was fine.
Yeah, he was fine with it. But there's just, see, this, I don't think he gets that a lot. But people that are Evergreen fans are like hard.
Right.
Hardcore. That was always my band. Like, they were always my faves. I mean, I did the same thing with Aaron, the singer, because he lived in, when I lived in San Francisco, Aaron lived in the East Bay, and he was doing another band that, you know, wasn't really like Evergreen, but like when I met him, I probably was weirder to him than I was to Jason, because I was younger and closer to my Evergreen time, but those Evergreen records are still like real. They occupy a formative. They're huge.
So for that, hearing that record and going, well, there's got to be more.
Yeah, I mean, I was like discovering all this. I discovered Evergreen first, and I'm not even sure that I understood that there was like the whole world of this type of music. Not that necessarily sounded the same, because Evergreen sounds very different from a band like Swing Kids or I don't know, you know.
Any of Pearson's stuff.
Any of Justin Pearson's stuff, or any of, you know, it sounds different. But there was some aesthetic or some mindset that connected all these people together. So I got to, and let's see, there was other stuff that I would have been into, like when I was still at the end of high school. I can't remember. I'd have to like look at my
records. Was it like,
records.
Was it hardcore? Did you hear the word emo yet?
Emo was not in circulation yet. Not around me. I feel like that came like a couple years later. And it was kind of applied not only to, it really, I feel like that was applied mostly to like the Gravity Records stuff.
Right.
And like Antioch Arrow, Heroin, Click a Tat, all that stuff. And it was a, it really at the time was kind of like a pejorative term. I don't think it was self-applied.
Right.
And when someone, when a band was called emo at that time, like you knew exactly what that meant. It had more to do with it. It had something to do with the music, but it also had to do with the fashion.
Right.
Which I was really drawn to.
What
I
was
loved,
the fashion then?
I mean, the fashion was high water pants, a button up short sleeve shirt, a white belt, a pair of steel toe Doc Martin short.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The low cut.
Yeah. A like sort of what we would have called a Romulan haircut. I mean, look at a picture of Justin Pearson in like 1993 or four.
And at that time, when someone looked like that, that was different than a couple years before when you were sort when you saw that look. But you say you were drawn to it. What was, why was it, why were you drawn to it?
I mean, I just, it was, it became very clear to me even when I was that young that like there were some different strains of punk rock. And like at that time, stuff like, you know, the like Revelation stuff, or maybe like Earth Crisis.
Right, the Victory.
The Victory Records stuff, the like kind of like buff guys with the shaved heads that just, I don't know, it seemed like too close. I don't know, like maybe too close to the people that at that time in my life. And me judging books by their covers, it felt like those are the people that I'm trying to get away from.
Yeah, I felt that same way. I was into it for a minute, and then I was like, there's something else than Chugga Chugga.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to like be with kids that were weird. I felt weird myself. And
were you playing music by then?
Yeah, pretty much. And like, yeah, my freshman year of college, I met all the people that ended up becoming Ex Ignota, and it was actually kind of a weird mix of people because there were two brothers in the band that were both straight edge.
Oh,
and
wow.
They pretty much remained straight edge the whole time that that band existed, but the rest of us were all weed smokers and kind of unrepentantly so.
Right.
And we were, I don't know. It just kind of all mixed together and it was no big thing. It was not a big thing, although I remember when we put our first record out on Ebullition, there were some people around that felt like that was a problem because they knew that we were kind of like pot-smoking people. And yeah, because
That straight edge stuff had such, that was still like talked about? Or not talked about, but like it affected people's opinion of that music.
I mean, it didn't affect it enough for Kent McClard to not put the record out. But yeah, I mean, people, you know, I mean, also like we're kind of like the new people, new band in town. We're kind, you know what I mean? There was a lot happening, a lot of politics.
Right.
Who did
you meet first
teenage
when you were
politics.
Doing the band? I mean, who did you meet in the scene, or when did you meet Kent? Like those kind of things that sort of...
I mean, it would have all been like, I was meeting people, we're talking about music, oh, there's a show happening, let's go to the show, there's Kent and, you know, whoever's playing. It's hard for me to remember.
Yeah, that's normal for the show. It's okay.
It's kind of hard for me to remember. Although, so that would have been my freshman year, and at that time there was a place in Goleta called the Living Room that was doing shows, that continued to do shows, and they were the established place. Run by a guy named John Lyons, who was also a recording engineer, and he recorded stuff at the living room.
Wow.
And
do you know when he started it?
I don't. It was before I got there, like well before. And he was a little older, and he was very established in the scene and very, very loved. Like people really liked him. He was super nice. A real like booster of just
making noise,
youth energy, you know, yeah. Just like a supporter of weird people.
So there were shows there.
But for some reason, maybe it was because we felt like there wasn't a space that, or maybe there just weren't, didn't feel like there were enough spaces that could accommodate the people that we knew were coming through or would come through if there was a place to play.
Right.
We started doing shows in our apartment, and this was I don't know if you ever heard of a place called the Pickle Patch.
Aoki, right? Wasn't he a part of that?
Yeah. So our house was called 6554 Sabato Tarde. It was just the address. And it was the place that was the like first apartment that was doing shows.
No shit.
So we did that for a year.
And
we did
shows.
I mean, dude, we had Man is the Bastard, VSS.
What?
Promise Ring, Lifetime. God, who else? Embassy. Bastard Noise.
So like 95, 94 kind of stuff.
I would say like 94.
Fucking hell.
I mean, we did shows all the time, every weekend, and we were so clueless. We had neighbors above us that we didn't know. We never asked them if this would be okay. We never talked to them. They were just regular college kids trying to go to college, and we were having these.
How many people were there?
I mean, you could cram. If you crammed, we could get 35 people, 40 people. We had Dahlia Seed. I don't know if you remember that band.
Yes, of course.
Rain Like the Sound of Tran. No, Sevens. Do you know that Discord band, Sevens?
No.
They were like. There was like a little strain of Discord that was like reggae.
Interesting.
So there was Rain Like the Sound of Trains, and then when they ended, it was a band called Sevens. So they came through.
And this was phone, flyer, book your own fucking
phone
life.
Phone and letter. And letters. I mean, this was a time when like we... As Ex Ignota, we were booking our tours using dialers.
Yep.
And that's how we made all our long distance calls. And it was like the most normal thing. We just had a dialer.
That gets brought up just dialers. As much of, I can't remember.
Yeah. I mean, anyone that was like, anyone that talks about a dialer immediately is like, okay, you're real. I know you were in
it. The Brave guys, Jimmy World guys, they all dialers. Yeah,
everybody.
But what when you guys were doing that, you had the show, you were putting on these things, was it just we're having fun in the moment, or was there...
We just loved it. Like, I was so enchanted by the idea of this intentional community of musicians that really stretched across the country. His Hero Is Gone. That was an intense one.
Wow.
I just was in love with this idea that we were meeting these people from all kinds of different places with all kinds of different accents, and everybody was...
And they're bringing records with them, too.
And they're bringing records with them, and, you know, but there was just a lot of... At the same time that you felt these really cool, interesting differences, like there was this core of similarity, like we shared a lot of the same ideas about like politics, and I mean what we understood about politics, which was very little,
right?
But I don't know, man, it was really, really beautiful. It was actually like such a I don't know if I would be making music still had I not, if I didn't have that, those years like deep in me.
It's funny to talk to so many people that later in what they're doing, right? Yeah. Andy Rich from Initial, he runs a casino. Of course he does.
Yeah.
Because he ran a festival and it was right. successful. He did Crazy Fest forever. Where kind of people, it's almost like this other school that you went to.
Yeah.
And it was this, not saying school of punk rock, but like this DIY sort of way that you sort of went about things.
Yeah, that's really,
I think, goes far.
It's like the DIY mindset that really carried me through. I mean, you know, even as I got more and more involved in like what we now think of as the music business, which is like where my life and livelihood is now, like the way that I found my way to that place was really doing stuff on my own forever and ever. Even early Hiscold Messenger, I was still using methods that I learned then.
Wow.
You know, and it seemed normal to me. I never felt like, if only so-and-so would call me back and put my record out. Like, for me, it was just like, I have this cool little record. I'm going to press it myself. I'm going to make the covers myself. And I'm going to sell them out of the back of my car. Like, there's nothing weird about that. That's something that I've been doing my whole life. And I feel like that had really gave me a leg up over a lot of people.
Because they were probably waiting.
They were waiting for something. And
they never put out their own shit.
I get it, but that just has never been my way. And the reason that it hasn't is because of those days.
Going back to that quickly, the band, like what was, so the school, you still did the shows, you're in your band.
Yeah.
What was the life cycle of that? Or what were some other moments that you remember?
I mean, we did a lot of touring. We did a lot of tours with Torches to Rome, who I still think of as one of the greatest bands of that era.
Like, what label were they on?
I don't know what label they were on.
But they were from Santa Barbara?
No, or? they were. Do you know that band?
It vaguely. So that's why I was asking questions. Be like, I don't know if I did based on the label.
Torches to Rome. I don't know what label they were on, but it was, Sarah Kirsch's band at the time. Sarah Kirsch was Mike Kirsch. It was a 3-piece band, and they were from the East Bay, and they were the hardest fucking band.
Wow.
I mean, like, to this day, incredible. We did a lot of touring with them, a lot of touring with The Locust, a lot of touring with Jenny Piccolo. Those were like the three bands that we would travel around with. And we were like, our band was probably not the hardest of those bands, but definitely the weirdest.
Describe it for anybody that's listening.
It was...
you can make obscure references too.
I mean, I think that people in the band were bringing lots of different influences that... I don't know. Like, we listened to a lot of Sonic Youth. And a lot of... I don't know, just weird jazz and I don't know, just stuff all over the map. I don't even know how we found it or how it would have come into our possession. But so that band, we toured a lot. We bought a van in Goleta for $500 and like drove it into the ground. I mean, we traveled around the country for months and months in that thing. Came home, and at that, I remember a very specific thing that, like, just felt like things were changing, which was Me and a couple of the guys from my band, including Scott Hirsch, who I still work with to this day. Scott and I still, he was in Exignado with me, and 30 years later, almost, like, we're still making records together.
That's amazing.
It's so, it's beautiful. But anyway, me and Scott and a few other friends from Santa Barbara that all were in that little circle, and Chris, the guitar player from Jenny Piccolo, and maybe James, I don't remember if James, the bass player of Jenny Piccolo, I don't remember if he was there too, but we all went to go see Tortoise at the Roxy. This was the first time that Tortoise was touring, like, on
wow.
their very first record, because we were like all starting to find our way to
the weird, like the other weird
stuff, like Thrill Jockey and
Quarterstick,
and you know, like we'd already been into like June of 44 and Rachel's. All of a sudden,
yeah.
It's like, oh, piano, and
that's so cool,
Sonora Pine, and we'd like kind of moved through that, and that was so hardcore adjacent. Oh, look at that.
Yeah, we can edit. Don't worry.
Yeah.
No, you're fine.
This is Luke. So
Luke,
is
I'm Tom.
This is Tom. Luke is my front of house engineer, and the amazing thing is that when Luke and I started working together many years ago, his first job was doing sound for Sonic Youth on the Daydream Nation tour.
Wow.
Which is like mind blowing to me. I still can't believe it. We had done a lot of touring, put records out. We were getting older. I mean, this is all happening in the span of 2 years, but we're young. So the years mean more.
So much.
And so we're getting into this, all this other stuff. We're like voraciously reading The Wire magazine. And all of a sudden it's like Mouse on Mars, Oval. Anyway, so we go to see Tortoise. It was like when Dave Pajo was still in the band. And CN Cake was on the bill, too.
Oh, wow.
And another sub-pop band called Five Style.
I love Five Style.
Yeah.
Instrumental.
Yeah. So it was those three bands at the Roxy.
I have not thought of Five Style in like 20 years.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, there you go. So we all went to see that show. We drove our shitty van down to Hollywood to see that show at the Roxy. And I just remember like things felt different after that show. And it could be hard pressed to say exactly why, other than we just watched people that seemed to us at that time to really be able to play and to like be taking their musicianship seriously. And at that time, that felt really appealing.
Yeah.
So then it was kind of like, then we started to drift a little bit. You know, some of us were getting ready to be done with school. Some of us were just feeling like there's a lot of rules in this hardcore scene.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of like things that you aren't supposed to do. There's like a way that you're supposed to look, even if it means with a white belt and high water pants and stuff, that's a uniform. I don't know. It just felt kind of like, it felt a little, it got less interesting,
right,
to me. But it was still, you know, we saw, you know, another place, we saw a ton of shows at the Jabberjaw.
Right.
I don't know if you know that place.
Yes, totally.
That's a place that, like, I saw more. It's getting a little loud.
What do you think? That lady has a, she should do your intro. She's got a voice that fucking travels.
I mean, we could probably go back in here.
You want to do that?
Let me ask them if that's
Let's
cool.
ask them, then we'll do it. Yeah, no sweat.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We used to drive from Santa Barbara often, like sometimes it seemed like every week, to see shows at the Jabberjaw. And that was another place that we encountered music that was not totally in the scene that we existed in. And that was really good for us. So we would see...
like punk stuff, right?
We'd see like Rocket from the Crypt.
Right.
Or... saw a lot of Unwound shows there, but also weird stuff. Like, I don't know. I can't remember.
But it was like something like, so you're maybe a junior in college and you're like, we're going to the Jabberjaw.
Yeah, like sophomore, junior. And another place we would see shows that was... I could never really find anybody that knew this, could remember this place, but then an Instagram page started, this place called the Macondo. Have you ever heard of this place?
No.
It was kind of short-lived, but it was rad. And so I would see, like, definitely remember seeing a Julia show there. Loved that band. You know, another band that I really loved was Jawbreaker. That was like, they were up there with Evergreen for me. They really spoke to my teenage love of...
And they were playing the Jabberjaw, right?
Oh, totally. We definitely saw Jawbreaker play there. And I mean, they were like, I don't know, in a weird way, they were like the standard bearers of... It wasn't, they really sounded nothing like Gravity Records bands, but
right.
They were kind of like, I just loved him. I loved him. I loved the way that he wrote. He was a great writer.
Did you like the doc? Did you see
Yeah, I did. I did like it. Yeah, totally.
I just thought it was funny too that Dan from The Promise Ring was like a producer on it.
Yeah.
And just being able to know how Adam saved all that stuff for years and years and years. And I don't know, he saved it because he wanted it.
Yeah.
And then it ends up making the documentary so beautiful because all this stuff is
totally
saved. That was also really beautiful about them, that he kind of knew, okay, something's cool is happening.
Yeah. Yeah. God damn, I love that band. When I lived in San Francisco later, he ran a video store called Lost Weekend. That was our local video store. Like, and he clearly knew a ton about film as well, because it was an impeccably curated video store.
Oh, that's so cool. And again,
I was always so starstruck,
right,
when I would see him.
Fuck.
Like, oh my God, it's the drummer from Jawbreaker. I mean, I had kind of moved away from that music, but it's still... you know, that stuff, that their music got really deep inside me when I was young, so.
I think what's interesting about the time period that you were in school, which was just before me, I started in 96, you started a few years before. You talked earlier about not having the internet or it being kind of slow, still flyers, still word of mouth. And then it's sort of this forgotten moment before...
Yeah.
01 and the internet and everything's going crazy. Like, it's that little pocket of time that we're not going to get back. Like, going to that Jabberjaw, not having your phone. And I love it now, right? We were texting an email. We found each other on Instagram. Beautiful. But that's that last little moment. And I think your age, my age was that.
Yeah.
I just think the way that music was curated or sort of talked about or presented, you had to put the work in.
Mm-hmm.
You had to go to the show.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about that or that?
I do. Time? I mean, I think about I definitely think that for those that were inclined to do that kind of work, that's why the memories of the feelings from that time feel so rich, because it was a fully engaged practice being with that music.
Yeah.
And it was very innocent, and it had not, I mean, we were trying to sell each other records, but it was not being commodified in the way that it feels like everything is, every moment of life is now, being taken and packaged and sold back to us.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about this over the past couple of days, because I just read this book by this French author named Annie Arnaud, who wrote this book called The Years. And it's basically her autobiography, but also kind of an autobiography of a generation. She was born during World War II, and she's still alive now. She's now in her 80s. But
wow.
It really was this like profound, I would call the book profound. I couldn't even say if I loved it, because it's so complicated, and I didn't walk away from the book feeling uplifted. Because part of the subtext of the book is that the way that technology and capitalism in tandem have made memory and the process of aging, have made them cheap in a way. And that's not like what the book's about. It keeps coming up. So to go back to, you know, this time that we're talking about in the mid-90s, when we're using dialers and payphones and writing each other letters and making zines and exchanging zines and making our own record covers and stuff, like, you know, that those memories are really rich, because we were not distracted from what we felt our mission was at the time.
Right.
And I'm so thankful to have that.
I think about where I can remember it and then put myself in the present and go, why do you have 17 notifications on right now? Do one thing. Right. Remember when you could do one thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know people are, you know, kids are better at it than us probably, and they've already figured out, but I love that I can go back to a time when that didn't exist.
Right.
And yes, there was 1,000 things going on. Yes, I had things I had to do, but I felt more
focused.
I'm focused on this. I'm at this show with Mike at the Jabberjaw. We're here. We're in the moment. We're not scrolling.
Yeah.
And I feel like I honor that, or sort of try to remember that in certain moments, because you get lost.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, that time is, and also that music was really helpful to me.
How
at
so?
At that moment in my life when I felt confused and unsure about who I was and what I was, you know, not even what I wanted to be doing with my life. Like, I hadn't even come to that question yet. It was more just like seeing people living out themselves on a stage was good. It was valuable, you know? It was valuable for a guy that is, you know, I'm like, think of myself as a pretty introverted person. I mean, I've obviously trained myself to,
yeah, totally,
to be outward facing too, because it's part of my job, and it's fine, it's no problem. But you know, I don't know, there was a lot of that energy in that universe right then. Introverted people trying to understand how to be with each other and make this community that was totally on the fringes of whatever was happening in the overculture.
Right. And to feel safe.
And to feel safe and feel like we could still be silly and, you know, explore and, you know, date each other, all this stuff. It was like a parallel. It was like a parallel teenagedom. You know, I wasn't a sports guy. I was really into skateboarding. I was really into surfing. But I just wasn't built for competition in the way that it was presented to me where I grew up in Southern California. And I was always looking for an alternative or something that I could do by myself. And music, and especially hardcore at that time, gave me those things right when I really needed them.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
So when you left school, you saw Tortoise, you go on all these shows, and you're sort of shifting. What in your head was like, I want to do this now? Or were things more clear about, I'm going to do music? I'm going to, or no?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I had all kinds of jobs. I've had all kinds of jobs in my life. I mean, I was working a full-time job until I was 40 years old. But music always has been a really pure thing for me. And the way that I make it, I guess that people must hear that, the vulnerability in it or something. I don't exactly know. And I'm hesitant to I'm hesitant to interrogate that too much. Because that is like an area of magic and mystery at a time when those two things are pretty hard to find. Right. So, I'm still like an omnivorous music fan as well. Like I still listen to music all day long, every day. And I'm still digging through record stores like I was then, you know?
So it stayed with you.
Oh, totally. I mean, totally. It's deep in me, and it still is like a very joyful place for me. Records are just the artifact, the ritual, putting them on, flipping them over. It's like, you know, it's deep.
Yeah, it's pretty deep.
Yeah, but like when I saw that you were talking with Tony Joy, I was like, oh, okay. Tony Joy. I love Tony Joy.
Is that how you
Joy.
Found it?
Yeah.
So many people found the show with Tony.
Yeah.
I got to see him on Saturday.
Yeah.
He called me. He's like, you want to get, you know, brunch? And it was pouring in LA.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, it's Tony fucking Joy. I'm going to Highland Park and having breakfast with him. Because it's, and just to spend time with him and hear him speak, it just, I don't know. Like, it's like these people.
Yeah.
Tony is
a big one for me, like, because UOA, of those bands, I feel like I've mentioned multiple bands that were my favorite band.
That's okay.
But like in that like sort of fucking aggro, shredded energy vibe, like UOA to me is like, dude, I mean, that it's like
that deserves
so
its own
heavy, and Tony's playing is weird. It's like he was on one. And so, yeah.
So you saw that and you're like, okay, we're going deeper.
Well, I mean, I just figured that anybody who's talking to Tony Joy, like, probably knows enough. If I were to have a conversation with them, I could, like, reference these.
Julia.
I could reference Julia. And you would know what I was talking
right.
about. It's like, it's sort of this arcane knowledge that I have, like, a couple people that I can talk to about
nice.
About Julia 7 inches, but not many.
Not many. But that's what's so cool about this, and I think Tony doing it and other people have sort of piped up, and especially with Ken Shipley
yeah.
with Numero starting to sort of say, here's what happened, here's what's going on, and
yeah.
and you should listen to it, and here's why. And I think there's an opportunity. We made fun of, you know, oh, the internet. Well, now, I mean, there's a kid I was talking to last night from Brazil.
Yeah.
He was telling me all these bands he found. He's never left São Paulo.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, fuck, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's...
like, he likes Boss Icon. I'm like, how the fuck did you find that?
Yeah. It's funny because... yeah, when that Indian Summer comp came out that Ken put out, I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? You're putting an Indian Summer record out? I mean, that is so awesome. But, I mean, I'm going to buy it. Who's going to buy it?
Right.
I hope many people. But, like...
I mean, the postmark stamp stuff that he did was legendary. People were like trading that stuff like crazy.
I mean, it's cool. I'm glad he's doing it, but
yeah.
it really, it's very, it's like, it's just strange. It's like the music of my childhood all of a sudden is like this new currency that.
And getting redemption.
Is getting a redemption, and actually is like the story that's being the like narrative about it is really it's like discussion about that community is cool, is really cool.
Yeah. So then, with His Golden Messenger, how long has that been going on? That as a project for you?
I started His in probably 2005, maybe 2006, something
and
like that.
And based in.
I started it like at the very end of my time in San Francisco. My wife and I moved from San Francisco to North Carolina in 2007. And
we had talked about that because I went to school and went to Elon in the from 96 to 2000.
Crazy. That's where you went. Elon. Holy shit. That's...
And I found the weird punk kids and I hung out at the radio station and I went
yeah.
to 5 shows a week.
Yeah, yeah.
Cradle, Lizard and Snake.
Right.
Like everywhere. But that... cool spot to roll into.
Yeah.
Merge.
Yeah.
Yep Rock's. I interned at Yep Rock.
Whoa.
And Red Eye.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow. In Ha River?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was my first internship.
That's incredible. Yeah. I mean, Merge is, it's funny that I've made a ton of records for Merge at this point.
Really?
I mean, they've put out all my records.
Oh, right.
They put out all my records, but at this point, it's a lot. It's like 10 or
wow.
more. And I'm...
How do you like it there? Or in, you know, North Carolina or just, you know, kind of settling there?
It's cool. I mean, I've been there 15 years, so it's now a third of my life. And
I should have asked you to bring cheer wine. That was my bad.
yeah, it's great. I mean, it feels like home. We have two kids. They were
awesome.
Both born there, and it feels like home. Every time I'm back in California, you know, I'm a California native, so it's.
I like that we're doing it today near Goleta.
And that's it's wild, wild to be in this particular spot.
So sorry to derail, but you're in North Carolina. You've been doing this, you know, and then, but you said you had a full-time job while you were doing this project as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't have like two fucking pennies to rub together from music until I'd been doing it for 25 years, you know? And it's only because I had this like training in how to sort of deal with music on your own terms that I learned from hardcore music. I really think that's the only reason why I kept doing it when so many other people would have been like, I'm out.
Or tried to do the thing that was happening moment. That's what I felt.
Sure. Tried to just hop on something that might work. I mean, I've tried that. I've tried that occasionally, but, you know, people can tell when it's not genuine.
When was the moment when you were like, holy shit, I can do this full time?
I mean, there wasn't a moment where I was like, hot dog. It was more like, I'm getting so busy with music, and if I just quit my job, I can actually like set my booking agent free to actually go take these offers. And wow. So like in 2014, I quit my job. I worked for Duke at the time, and
Duke Coffee House, another great venue.
Yeah.
My band played there.
Yeah. What was your band?
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
I got to know.
We were called Twisted Kites.
Awesome. That's pretty emo.
And then the other one, actually, I will say, because you did, it was Mirror 42. The only reason, it was a hardcore band, and some of the guys are now in other hardcore bands that, like, they love to, like, do trivia with it, but the only reason I called it Mirror 42, it was so stupid, because I was straight edge, the 24th letter of the alphabet is an X.
There you go.
So I would just go Mirror 42 X, and then I'd put X's around it, because that's so stupid. Anyway.
That's some straight edge. That's some straight edge for you.
So you left Duke. You were like, booking agent, go nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, because my booking is still my same guy. He's the fucking best. He's, in my opinion, he's the best booking agent. So when I was like, Adam, I just quit my job, dude. So please keep me busy enough. I mean, I already had two kids.
Wow.
I was like, it was a little like stepping off a cliff. I thought I could make it work, but it was stressful as hell. It's still stressful, but not even remotely like it was in that moment.
That's really rad. That's beautiful.
Thanks. Yeah. So I was already making records for Merge at that point in time, but I was just like a new band for them.
Right.
But they've all those guys, you know, Merge is like, feels like family now. I mean, Luke, who you met, is married to Laura Balance, one of the owners.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, like Laura drove us to the airport at 4 a.m. this morning. So like we're all tight and we all live close to each other. And I mean, the first time I ever saw Laura Balance play in Superchunk was in Santa Barbara in like 1993 or 4. And wow. I was just like, I love this band. I mean, I love Superchunk, and they were a big one for me. They were kind of like hardcore adjacent. I don't know. They're not hardcore, but yeah, I don't know. It's just, I've had a funny life in music that I'm thankful for. I love it.
Last thing I'll ask you was, what would you say to someone out there that's, you know, searching or doing it for 10 years and thinking I'm going to stop, or what were those things that hardcore, you know, was reminding you or telling you to kind of keep going? Like if someone,
I mean,
that a weird question? Or
it's not a weird question, but it's not one that I feel. I mean, there's certainly no. There's no shame in getting to a point where you're like, I don't think I can keep doing this anymore.
Yeah.
And just walking away. I think like I'm so, I have such a problem with people telling me no.
I have the same problem.
That it's like, I will do something for 30 years to prove to them that I can actually do it. And I feel like, so there's like maybe a tenaciousness in me that is like borders on obsessive. I mean, look, I think that you to like play a long game with any artistic medium, you have to have an internal connection to it that has nothing to do with the public face of it. You have to practice it because it's the way that you communicate something about yourself to yourself. And I feel like that's what Hiss has always been to me. Like when I found my voice, my figurative voice with Hiss, I'm not doing anything that a million other people haven't done, but it's just, I found the right set of words to use to talk to myself and about my problems and the things that I love and, in a language that makes sense to me and, you know, to do it with vulnerability. And I think that maybe people respond to it because it feels real to them, because it's always been this like this personal thing that I have with myself. And
it's been real since you started playing music or going to those shows.
I mean, I think so. It's just been
buying
this,
the record, hanging out with friends. It wasn't. You're not doing it. I always tell, I can't not do this.
Yeah,
I have to.
I think so. I mean, there certainly have been days in my life when I've been disgusted with music and everything that it feels like it's made me do. It hasn't actually made me do anything, but you know, music is hard. It's hard to make a life in music. I'm like, I must be part of the like 1%. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
That like, it's hard. It's hard on your ego and it's hard on your body. And but I just think that it's the best medium. It's like, it's the most beautiful, transcendental form of communication. You know, it's just part of me.
I love it. Thank you.
Yeah, man.
Thanks for doing this.
Of course.
Feeling blue, can't get out of my own mind. But I know how to sing about